You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today, I'm talking to Sean Walsh. This episode is an hour or so, and you can find another 45 minutes of extra material with Sean Walsh available exclusively to members of the Insiders Club. We'll talk about how Sean is unsettled by the aggressive environment on panel shows. We'll talk about him getting kicked out of college and the coziness of melancholy that he found as a young person. And we'll cover a genuinely startling and I think unique DIY technique for ridding oneself of nervous energy pre-show. All of that available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, we're going to get stuck into this episode. I'm not going to intervene in the middle to talk to you about anything because of, I think, the sensitive nature of some of what we're going to talk about. You may know Sean as just an extraordinary observational comic. He has a phenomenal talent for finding the funny, for really zapping into a subject and knowing what to talk about and how to wring out of it every possible ounce of funny. He's a phenomenal physical performer. His act outs are second to none. You can learn a lot from him. And also, as many of you will know, he was about to break big in 2018, appearing on Strictly Come Dancing, which is a sort of celebrity dancing show on the BBC. Absolutely enormous profile. And pictures surfaced of him kissing his dance partner. We will discuss, to a certain extent, the tabloid uproar and the accusations that followed and the effect that those had and continue to have on his life and work. I think that's all I'm going to say for now. You will appreciate when we get to that part of the interview, the pressure that Sean is under to not say anything that could be taken out of context. I'm going to leave it up to Sean to talk about those things as and when we get to them. I hope you enjoy this interview with Sean Walsh.
I'm probably more pretentious than you might expect or people expect. So
okay. What do you think we've started now? What do you think people expect from you when they meet you?
I hadn't even considered that. That there's not as much sort of thought into what I do as there is, perhaps. That, you know, like a lot of people, for example, I don't know if I'm talking about your listenership, but the public or the audience will often think I'm drunk during a set. I've never drank during a normal gig.
Sure.
I've drank at late shows. That's my rule.
Yeah.
Late shows or maybe abroad if it's a gig in Norway or something. So there's that, and then, and you think, people just think that maybe I don't care as much as I do. That's what I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you get because I've seen those sorts of comments are like, this guy's on crack.
All that stuff, yeah.
Why do you think people think that? What quality is it in you that people think is drunk?
So it'd be easy to start off with the look.
Yeah.
It's a safe place to start. Long hair, shabby, dishevelled beard. I've abused my body since the age of 17. Fags, booze, eating badly. You know, not exercising. I've gone for it. I lived my 20s the sort of, not the way you're meant to, but, you know, in the. Well, how could you say? I try to enjoy myself. And so that, and as well, I suppose, to be fair, There was a show called Shaun to be Wild in Edinburgh that was an hour exclusively dedicated to material about drinking. It was an hour, a solid hour.
Yeah.
I didn't really realise the significance of that before I went into that. And obviously I've had to live with the sort of consequence of that since. I've not been able to sort of rid of that.
A lot of your stuff, a lot of the clips available on YouTube are hangovers. Just hangovers, vomiting. Like,
I know.
Horrific hangovers.
I saw a clip on Twitter. Yeah, someone filmed a clip of Dave last night and I saw it. I found it embarrassing.
Like Jaeger bombs. It's almost like you had deliberately set out to go, I'm the guy that gets hammered.
I think I did a little bit.
Why would you do that?
I'll tell you why. Do you have any, just out of interest, could you guess why?
because I would imagine in the same way as we can divide comics into people who have jokes about service stations and people who have jokes about train stations.
Yes.
It's like a reflection of your life.
It is, well, it certainly was a reflection of my life. So there's some things I remember clearly. There's some things that I could talk about in this that I have a clear memory of. So you know, that show, Shaun to be Wild, was written, shall we say, during my time on the much-loved Channel 4 stand-up show, Stand Up for the Week.
Okay.
Right? The topical stand-up show. Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So not very popular amongst...
I didn't know it wasn't very popular.
Well, no, it wasn't. No.
Do
it
you mean
was always,
audiences or popular amongst comics?
Probably audiences, but comics. There was always articles. There were snide comments online and that sort of thing,
okay.
Right? Now, the what was happening is that was sort of Monday till Wednesday or something? That we were working sort of like a 9-to-5 job, and then we'd go and try the stuff out, and you'd try the stuff out the next day, and then you would do the show on the Wednesday, I think. Then there was...
When you say working like a 9-to-5 job, you mean writing the stuff.
Excuse me. So with Stand Up for the Week, each of the comedians had a team of writers because, you know, and everyone did. There was no... Mm-hmm. I don't mean, yeah, there's not many people that would be able to just sit down and write a
topical in a set
that,
sure.
Yeah, that they'd be confident with, okay, going on television. So each of the comics had a little mini team of writers, and you would turn up to the office 9-to-5, work on this stuff, go through the papers. My job was entertainment news, ironically, and then you would do the show, the live show on Wednesday night at the Clapham Grand. And then I think at this time, I was on tour, probably in this period of my life, and it was a time in my life where I think when I was doing corporates, I was busy. There, it was, you know, you get the email, you're doing Edinburgh. What the hell am I going to talk about?
Yeah,
I'm not doing anything. I don't. Well, okay, you could chuck all this Stand Up for the Week stuff together and probably do a sort of, you know, like a.
Anything that wasn't good enough to use, you could use the offcut. No, that's not really.
Well, I mean, I still think you could have used all the stuff that was on Stand Up for the Week, to be honest.
Right, fair, okay.
But for whatever reason, I didn't want to do that. And then all I was doing outside of that, like anyone that was 25, it was certainly any of my mates, was going out and getting absolutely shit faced. That was all there was to talk about. You either talk about going to work and work on a TV show or doing a corporate, you're not going to talk about that. Yeah. Or just me being drunk and being hungover like most people that age. So that's... And then I sort of thought, well, maybe that could be my thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? My shtick. You sure. Know, how that sort of... That frame in which a lot of British comedians fall into when... That's your character. That's your two-dimensional character.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Right, in that way that Dylan Moran is... I've fudged his surname there because I grew up calling him Dylan Moran and I believe it's Moran. I don't know.
Well, so I say Moran. I don't know.
I went halfway between really badly.
Yeah.
But he will get criticisms of... Or he'll get people mistaking his act for actual drunkenness.
Yes.
Because he's like does that kind of... I don't even know the word for it, but, you know, appearing to be pissed and things coming to you on stage.
He certainly did when he was younger.
Yeah.
In those old clips. But yes, I thought that would be my thing, you know. Like, I mean,
Did you feel like you needed a thing? Did you feel under pressure to have a thing, either from yourself or the industry? Because I really relate to that feeling in the early years, like, oh, it'd be good to have a thing, because you see other people who've got a thing.
Yes.
Kind of employing it, wielding it really usefully.
Absolutely. You know, a great example would be Jack D.
Yeah.
It's the best example. It's fantastic. Yeah. It's the moody guy. It's just so simple and so perfect. And you can, with Jack, with one look and one joke, just in 20 seconds, you know exactly who this person is. And then it...
Totally.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, and presumably, when you get comics like that, and a lot of them are the bigger, more famous names, someone like Sean Locke, you know who he is.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't... Although, but I wouldn't say Sean was a great example of that, personally.
Okay, go on.
Well, I think that Sean isn't... I don't think there's a necessary... I mean, tell me what you think, but I don't think Sean is necessarily has a character. You know, I think if you were to if you were to stick Jack in any sort of sitcom scenario, we would be able to, you know, we would be able to presume what Jack might do.
Cartoonish aspect to it.
The very cartoony aspect.
I think with comics like that, I think you could almost imagine them on the pages of Viz looking out at the audience going, right, readers? Do you know what I mean? Because we know how that person will react
absolutely.
To something.
Absolutely.
I think with Sean Locke...
And that's
Locke,
not to undermine it, of course.
No, not at all.
Of course, yes.
I think with someone like Sean Locke, the tone, the attitude that I most associate with him is there's a bit of material, I don't remember word for word, but about what he's talking about... when people ask you to do things and you're already busy, and it's like, am I trying to get a key on a fob, thinking, what am I, a fucking octopus? Do you know what I mean? Like that is such a, that attitude is like, bang.
Yes.
And the reason I mention it is, on a panel game, when you come to the character who is the grumpy guy or the beardy weirdo, as David O'Doherty has said on this show, he always sits in the same place on panel shows.
Right.
Because that's the beardy weirdo seat.
Okay.
I wonder whether that's part of the attraction of having a thing. Someone bats a ball at you and you know immediately how you're going to come back.
Yes.
Because that's how the character would respond, how that part of your personality would respond.
Yes.
Do you think that you... had or have a thing like that?
So had, I think when I actually started, when I started out, the first few gigs, I think actually that the sort of, I was going to say unintentionally, I actually can't remember, intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. But I think actually, as an open spot, I think it was a very good open spot, and there was a very clear sort of persona, and there was a very clear view of the world. And then I think I went away from that. And you'll know this from, because you saw the last Edinburgh show.
Yeah.
So you'll know. And then from being an open spot, where sort of things started going well for me, my life changed. And then I don't know, sort of I changed, what my view of the world changed, I don't really know. But then the act definitely changed. The act became a high energy act, of which it still sort of is. You know, there's certainly an energy there, but it was massive. And it mirrored certainly, which I said in that show, you know, I would look at like Michael McIntyre in a way, you know, I'd look at that and I'd go, wow, that's what I want to do. I never had any shame from day one about playing big rooms or anything like that. That was the dream. There was no question there, not ashamed. You know, sometimes you read interviews of people, you might even be one of them, they prefer the intimate venue.
Sure.
I'm not that guy.
Okay.
I want to, let's go. I want it to be massive. More laughter. That's what I want, is as many people laughing as possible. And you look at someone like Michael, who is the king of it, really. And I was sort of, I was essentially, I suppose, to a large degree, I was imitating that. And I lost my, what I'm sure you've referred to loads, you know, over the course of this podcast series, is the comic voice. I lost my voice. I lost who I was. I would find observations. I would find things that we did, that people did, and I would do routines about them. Those routines worked. The people in the room were laughing, sure. But, you know, you've got to... I don't know, you've got to give some of yourself, haven't you? And actually, the drinking, although I know... a lot of that sort of stuff is frowned upon, and I am embarrassed about some of it. Looking back, as I said, I caught some the other day. It still was me. It still was my life. You can't really question it. That's what I was doing. Unfortunately, it was just getting shit-faced. but it was still... There was some authenticity to it, you know.
Okay. Oh, I see. So the drinking stuff had more authenticity to it than the later, like the next phase of your career, which was being able to find... I don't mean make anything funny, but you've got such a great ability to get to the heart of what's funny about something. And you felt that kind of... You were running away with getting laughs at the expense of it being more authentic.
Yes. But absolutely, but you got it the wrong way around. I felt like I was being broader and then actually sort of tried to correct that with the drinking stuff.
Ah, yes. Okay, because the drinking stuff was authentic. more authentic.
But yeah, the drinking stuff was authentic. But as ridiculous as it sounds, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, that was my life. Outside of Stand Up for the Week, outside of the tour shows, that's what I was doing. So that's what I spoke about. And every year when you go up to Edinburgh, I don't know where you start. I don't know where you start on your notepad or whatever you do, how you decide what you're going to write about. For me, it's very simple. It's a catch up. You haven't seen this person, this Edinburgh person, in a year. And you sit down with them and they go, "What have you been doing?" And you go, "I'll tell you what I've been doing." And that's the show.
And I totally agree with you. I've never heard it put like that, but I totally agree with you.
What have you been up to?
Yeah.
You catch up. You haven't seen them in a year. That's it.
So when it comes to the authenticity, I'm just going to stay with this for a minute.
That's
the authenticity of that stuff, the drinking stuff, whatever it was, the stuff that you felt was more authentic. Can you give me an example of something you did that was a great workable bit that you didn't feel had that authenticity to it?
Okay, so like, for example, yes, I think I can. Because I think I spoke about it in the last Edinburgh show. So like, occasionally, sometimes I drop this bit, whatever. But like, the first time I did Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, right? The 7-minute set on that, when it was 7 minutes, was about the travel, when you get on a travelator at the airport.
And you approach the end, and
it says, you know, "Warning, you are now approaching the end of the travelator." There's an observation, and how did this come about? This must have come about because, I mean, I can't really remember it, but someone's not got to the end, they've messed this up.
Yeah.
You know, that we need a warning now.
I remember every time I go on one of those travelators, I remember your bit about complaining, who is it that doesn't go on one of them?
Oh yeah, and then you've got the people.
That's one of those things, you know, you get like a psychogeography of comedy where like every time you see a thing, you're like, you always remember that bit.
Yeah,
that's
same.
Definitely, yeah.
I have that with comics. So I think that would be a good example of, okay, there's maybe a funny observation, right? Mm-hmm. And you can act this stuff out and you can maybe take it in a direction. But really, what was that about? Why was I talking about that? I don't really know why I was talking about that. I wouldn't do that now. That would be a note in my phone. And then maybe if there was a bigger routine about me going on a holiday or something, then I'd bring it in.
Sure.
But just to talk about a travelator... Why am I talking about a travelator?
Do you know what it is?
You know what I'm saying?
Did you end up doing that more and more because you were doing big rooms? Is it kind of like Coldplay syndrome, whereby suddenly you're in a stadium, you've got to write stadium stuff?
It was fun, you know. It was fun to do as well. But these... thousands of people are laughing. It's amazing. You think you're doing it right, don't you? If you're doing the bit and they're laughing, you don't, especially at that age, you don't know what you're doing wrong. And then it's when you start, I don't know, catching bits on telly or maybe watching other comics, perhaps. And unfortunately, coming across bad reviews. I don't know, getting a vibe that people aren't liking this.
Yeah.
Why aren't people
What's going on? The proof that everyone likes it.
3,500 people like this. What's gone wrong here? Something's gone wrong.
And so you came to a point where you thought what's gone wrong is the the authenticity of it, or the fact that like it doesn't, like it's funny, but who cares? It's funny, but it doesn't matter.
What? I was listening. I was just confused by the question. Yeah. What was it?
Going through that process, yes, of realizing, hang on a minute, that Travelator routine isn't good enough, or isn't meaningful enough, or is pleasing the people in the room but not the critics.
What? Yeah, there's just something missing, isn't it? This isn't when you think, well, I've done a live at the Apollo, and I've been on a few Mock the Weeks, and I've been on Roadshow, and I've smashed these rooms. That there's no, you know, I prefer to be modest, but
you unquestionably did fantastically on all those things.
Exactly. But you know, I did. Whether people liked it or not, when they were watching, there was no question of whether I had, on the night, did my job effectively, and yet something's not quite working here. What is not working? I don't understand. Do you know what I mean? Like,
what is it that's...
What are you saying, what's not working?
No, well, I'm saying, A, what's not working, and B, where does that come from, the idea that something isn't working, if you are being booked on all these TV shows and doing great? What is it? Do you mean that you're seeing peers kind of get further than you?
I suppose there'd be an element of that. Not being... back in the day, not... How do you not sound
this is a bitter safe place or to regret, talk about or, how great
yes,
you are.
No, it's not that, it's absolutely not that, it's, but you know, why can't someone let me ever go at a blap, or what are the other ones, feeds?
Sure.
Funny.
Yeah.
Okay, like, that's what I want to do. What's going wrong here?
I suppose what I'm asking about is the extent to which your uncomfortableness, whether you try to conceal it or whether you are happy for people to see that you're uncomfortable.
What do you mean? What do you mean? Am I happy for people to know I'm uncomfortable?
Yeah, or like, not quite that. More like something in comedy. Some people in comedy are desperate to be liked.
Yes.
Are you desperate to be liked?
I would like, well, okay, but that's, okay, there's a different thing. I've gone through many different phases with this huge, huge topic that relates to comedians so often. And I used to think, I was obsessed with the audience liking me, and... I suppose if you start doing bits of telly, the public liking me, strangers, the love of strangers, but then I even used to say as a younger man, as a younger comedian, that I just didn't care what comedians thought. It wasn't for comedians. Like magic isn't for magicians. This is not for you. To this day, I still think one of my pet hates. I was talking to another comic about this. I won't say who, but, you know, a friend of mine, he's done the podcast. But a lot of comics, I think, make the mistake that because they can see what a comic is doing, that it is not good. It's just total madness.
Yeah.
Oh, he just does that. She just does that. Right, okay, because you've seen the framework, I can watch Kevin Bridges, a friend of mine, but I think one of the best comedians in the world. I can watch Kevin. I can do an impression of Kevin. I can see when I'm watching Kevin what Kevin has done. Kevin is one of the best in the world. Doesn't undermine his work at all in the slightest. So, you know, I never cared about what comedians thought. And then I don't know where really this change happened. And then I started to get... I think people would be openly cruel about me. Maybe not to my face, but I think I signed, I don't know if listeners understand this sort of thing, but you know, I signed with a big agency off the curb, you know, home to Lee Evans and McIntyre and Jack D and all these huge names. And I felt, now feeling doesn't make anything a reality, but you know, I felt sort of animosity from people. Things change. And I can have this conversation with people that have signed to big agencies. It changes. It might be partly in your head, but it's partly real.
And you signed quite young to them as well. So you were in the kind of the flush of, hey, we're all in a big gang together.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? And then when people start to go, I'm not, it's like, I can't come to the party because I've got to do some writing. Do you know what I mean? Yes. I've got to do a thing.
Yes.
And everyone's like, what's this?
Yes.
Suddenly that kind of imagined group of open mics, you know, not like taking on the world together.
I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean? There's a certain camaraderie that then is, that's viewed in a different light, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really have that group as an open spot. But just, I'm trying to think if I can give you an example. But, I mean, Edinburgh's not a nice place. For me, I would say, I don't really want to go into it. But you feel very, how I would explain it to people when I was up there is you feel like the kid in the playground sat on his own in the corner. I know we all feel like this to an extent, but like whilst everyone else is playing together, I've always felt like that in Edinburgh. It's I don't feel like it's for people/comics like me. And I think that really affected me. All these comics, you go up to Edinburgh, you kill the club. I was brought up on clubs, going to comedy clubs since the age of 17, and these guys and, you know, these comics coming up and just smashing these rooms, tearing the rooms to pieces. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I thought it was. And then you start doing comedy and you realise there's this other thing, it's a completely different thing. And you go up there and suddenly this thing that you were doing that was making lots of people laugh and enjoy their weekends is, let's be honest, frowned upon. I think you can say that.
Yeah.
I think you can say that.
Completely. And that could be worse. You could be Northern. Then every review could call you a Northern club comic.
Right, that thing.
Yeah, sure.
I was going to do a tweet about it and I thought, oh God, I don't want it to fucking start a discussion online. But this is the perfect place for it, probably. I go to Top Secret a lot. It's my favourite club, right? It's where I go. It's where I feel comfortable. Two different comedians in the last couple of weeks have said to me, I don't want people to think I'm a club comic. Mm. Like, what the fuck is going on? How sad is that? So to me, those club comics, that Mickey Flanagan was a club comic. I remember watching Mickey before. I used to open at the Comedian. That's insane.
Yeah.
20 minutes. He used to go on about the pipe at the, do you know the Comedian that well?
Oh, yeah,
the room.
Yeah,
there's a sort of big pipe and he used to talk about the pipe and how he fitted it. Amazing. All these wonderful comedians, Paul Tonkinson, and these people grew up, that are my favourites, like Ian Moore.
Yeah.
I'm trying to name drop all these guys because they're my favourite comics.
Yeah.
They're what I grew up on the circuit. Love them to bits. You know, Maloney, all these people. And then you got to Edinburgh and then suddenly you're not part of the gang. You're the enemy's a bit extreme, but you know what I'm sort of getting at. You're the outcast. You want to join in. You want to be invited to the party, don't you? And at Edinburgh, I don't think I ever felt like that. And then, sort of changes things, really.
Yeah. Do you?
Am I being clear? Please.
No, totally. I suppose I'm just thinking like I feel that at Edinburgh.
Yes.
And my reaction to it, whenever I feel like there's a cool gang, because the thing about comedy is that it's what you get if you're not cool.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? It's there. You feel like an outcast, you're welcome.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, Edinburgh is, you go, all the outcasts got together and decided to make some of us outcasts.
Yes, absolutely.
Shit.
That's perfect, yeah. Absolutely.
And my reaction...
Misfits, outcasts.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My just personality is such that if I feel like an outcast, I kind of want to go, oh, I wonder how I can get in with them. I feel like your personality is more like, if you feel like an outcast, you're a bit more like, oh, well, fuck off then, I'm not playing.
Oh, yeah, but it feels... Yeah, I mean, that's the way we... That's different ways of dealing with the same problem.
Sure, yours has more dignity than mine.
Well, no, I would love to be... I'd love to be part of it, part of everything, part of... Well, you know, Does it come down to being liked? It comes down to, you know, doing well. Imagine going, I don't even know what it's like. I got nominated for that award. And even when I was nominated for that award, an article went out about, and that was one of the happiest moments of my career, that. It was Romesh that told me. My phone was dead, and I was with Romesh, and he had just been nominated for Best Newcomer, and he told me that it was like in the history of the award, I think, or something, there was the most amount of nominations.
Okay.
And he went, and what about the main award? And I heard him on the phone go, uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. And you're there going, what the fuck's going on? Uh-huh. And you're like, well, there's no way. And then he looked at me and he went, yes! And we were in Edinburgh, and I ran down this high street in Newtown. I never remember the name of the roads. Like I'd scored a World Cup winner, just ecstatic, and I've felt part of it. I've been nominated, even up here.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? I've done it up here, so the clubs are now up here. I'm part of the thing. And then there was an article instantly the next day how I didn't deserve to be nominated because of a Comedy Central show that I did. It was my best mate that sent me the link. He didn't read the fucking article.
Oh,
he just saw an article like Sean Walsh nominated. So he sent me the fucking thing and I read it. And it was about how I didn't deserve it because of this show called Sean Walsh World. And it was horrible. And then for the next few days it was, you know, PR people going, okay, if anyone interviews and asks you, do you deserve to be nominated? It was a horrible experience. And obviously, I didn't win, whatever. But the whole thing was awful. From that, one of the best moments of my career to just 3 days of just, people don't think I deserve this. Horrible. Really horrible. I was 27 or something.
Can you look at that now and kind of recognise that one person writing an article shouldn't outweigh the satisfaction and the... Do you mean the person who wrote the article, they're not one of us. They're not one of the comics.
But you... yes.
Like, you really... It sounds like, obviously, that it kind it, of... It's got in exactly in the crack of your personality and went, fuck it, we'll get that in there, split.
Exactly. But then, of course, what happened was... Then, and I'm sure this has been mentioned on your podcast. You might have even mentioned it yourself. Have you been nominated?
Yes.
Yeah. No? Okay. But you'll know of this, like people's audiences change for those next 3 days.
Oh, yeah, ruined your life, apparently, yeah. Starfuckers. I can't remember who I got that on. Someone said, oh, you do basically get starfuckers for the last 4 days of the fringe.
Right, well, my audience just transformed to this sea of white hair and glasses.
Yeah.
So no. This is about a bloke who is incapable of managing life, living on his own. That's what that show was about.
Mm-hmm.
And no, this is obviously not going to be from you. So the next 3 shows just bombed. And then all these horrible reviews that I came about where suddenly people were then coming to the show because I've been nominated.
To watch you bomb in front of Silver Tops.
It was just an absolutely horrible experience. I don't even have that. You get an award for the nomination.
Yeah.
I don't even have it because it just reminded me of those crap 3 days.
Oh, man. Because when you did your show last year,
yes,
which was called
After This One, I'm Going Home,
which yes. was the title of, you were going to do that show the previous year,
uh-huh.
and that was what the Edinburgh show was called before you went into Strictly.
Before I went into Strictly,
and then
yeah.
you pulled the show, and you're like, that's because I remember the blurb of that, which is something along the lines of, people could look it up online, but it was something like, I write these blurbs all the time, and I can't be fucked anymore, and no one's ever thought. Was it that one?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
The blurb that was like, no one's ever... God, I respected the hell out of that blurb. It says something like, I'm sure no one has ever gone to see, do you want to go and see this comic? No, his blurb was shit.
Yes,
either come to this or don't. I couldn't give a fuck.
Yes, exactly.
It was very... I was like, stood up and saluted when I read that, you know, because it was all you and it was honest and it was like, who cares?
This That's quite funny as well.
Yeah, and funny. It wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just sort of venom. You know?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it was breaking the rules in a really fun way.
Yeah. It's harmless and silly.
Sure. So after this one, I'm going home. At that point, referred to, I fucking hate Edinburgh and I'm going to do it one more time and then leave.
That was the joke.
That was the joke.
The show before was called One for the Road.
Gotcha. I never got that joke. So it worked for me without knowing that. Yeah,
right.
Great.
So it's always, this is the last one. I hate Edinburgh so much that I promise you this is the last one. I'm not doing this again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one will be called One More.
Yeah, gotcha.
And I'll keep going back and it will keep being... Okay, but then I'm really going.
Sure.
And then, obviously, come to a certain age and it will be the last one. That would be very, very potent.
Lovely planning for that.
Yeah!
That show, so the one that I saw, Edinburgh Just Gone 2019,
mm-hmm.
was an incredibly good hour of stand-up. It was incredibly good. Mm. When I saw it with Josh and a couple of other mates and some friends of Josh as well. And we were just sat there going, I think this is going to be great. And it was fucking great.
Thank you.
That whole, the journey of that thing, there's so many different conversations to have, and at which point, I don't know.
Mm.
But the stand-up in that show was superb.
Good, thank you.
Do you think the stand-up in that show was so good because it was born of, not desperation, but it was like...
There was desperate, but you're right to use that word. There was a lot of desperation in that show. It was very desperate, yeah.
In that show, you kind of framed your career as, I keep nearly getting it and then I fuck it all up for myself.
And I stand by that.
Sure. Okay, yeah. Because at the time, I'll tell you how I felt. As a comic who doesn't bother TV too much.
Yes.
You know, when like... It's that thing whereby any comic that goes, I can't fucking make it work. And you go, have you seen your CV? Have you seen the amount of stuff you've done?
Yes.
Have you imagined your bank balance in the way that I have? Do you mean?
Absolutely. It is guilty of that. Absolutely is guilty of that. But I suppose all I ever meant, I actually thought that might come up at some point, what are you fucking up? Is that the question? What are you fucking up? Okay, bank balance aside, right? All right, you do the shows, but you do... Let me just think of the examples from the show. All right, so... You do... What's the one? 8 out of 10 cats does countdown. You bring on your block of cheese as your mascot. You go to cut the cheese. Instead of cutting the cheese, you cut your finger. Filming has to be stopped. There's blood everywhere. They might... rush you to hospital. they think your finger might come off. Do you remember this? Did I say it?
Yeah, you said that bit, yeah.
I've not been back on that show since.
Okay. Did you do well on that show besides that off-camera incident?
Well, not really. Well, I was just covered in blood and... and uncomfortable as ever.
Okay.
On a panel show and
What's the worst a panel show has gone? Like apart from that kind of knife blood related incident.
What's the worst a panel?
Like what's the time when you have most? Because I can think of gigs. I can think of shows where I've just particularly TV warm up. I've done a fair bit of warm up, and if I think of the worst thing I've ever done, I get like a cold chill of a memory of a particular warm up.
Like what? Just dying, silence.
I'm just dying
mean?
In front of, the panelists who were all my favourite comics.
Yeah.
And I'm just dying doing the fucking warm up and feeling like a piece of shit. Do you mean like those kind of inside crumpling ones?
The whole experience of argumental.
Yeah, okay.
Which did I mention that?
You didn't, but I know you did it. It was you and Robert Webb, was it? As team captains?
It was
captains.
Me and Robert Webb and Sean as the host, Locke. And, oh man. I was not ready. I was really not ready. This was not stand-up. It was not what it was. It was writing an argument. You're trying to win the argument. You argue for something. I don't know if it was now why coronavirus could be a good thing. Mm-hmm. And you would have to go and... I mean, I could do it now. This is the thing. But then I was just not ready. I could do my set. I could do it. The Edinburgh shows at that point weren't very good. The first two Edinburgh shows, if you squished them together, I think was a good, a decent newcomer show, but not on their own. And that's what I'd done. And I was with Robert Webb. I don't think you should be doing these shows when you're still starstruck.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Good point. Yeah.
I don't think you should be doing the show when you're all sat there going, oh my God, I can't believe it.
Yeah. So, yeah, because you can't be irreverent, you can't put someone down, you can't relax into it, right?
Absolutely. And you're out, and I felt out of my depth, and I was out of my depth, and it was just horrific. And that scarred me for quite a bit as well. I mean, I know, but it did. Look, I don't enjoy saying that. I don't want to say it scarred me, because I know the weight of that, of saying that. It did. These things really dented my confidence. I was not as confident as I appeared on Live at the Apollo in a purple suit doing a high-energy routine about Mortal Kombat. That's contained. That doesn't tell the story of who you are as a person. That's you doing a routine about Mortal Kombat. I was terrified. And now I was on this show with Argumento. I just shouldn't have done these things. I wasn't ready.
Were you communicating to anyone in the industry that you weren't ready for doing those
things? I was too scared to say no.
Yeah.
Because what if you then... You're so naive. You're so ignorant to it all. What if you say no to that and then that's the end? That's how you. Oh, that's how I genuinely used to think. Could I remember there were other people? You think it's all over tomorrow. I've got to do this now. It'll all be over tomorrow.
Yeah.
So
that comes up on this podcast all the time with people who you think you have an unassailable lead. Do you know what I mean? People are still like, well, you know, it could all end tomorrow. You go,
oh man. And no names, but. I've got friends, dear friends, great comedians, perhaps not, you know, known yet, not even done anything yet on as far as TV goes, I think, or very little, you know, and the frustration that comes with this business. And I'm just going, you are so lucky. You just get to be better and get better. And the more you don't do that TV show, the more you improve. This is fantastic. You are winning. You are going to get your shot. It's inevitable. And when you do... you'll be more ready than you ever were. Wow. If I could do that, you know, things I imagine would be different. It's a great thing. Yeah. I was just doing so much and I just was not ready. Just was not comfortable.
I was trying to get a sense in your Edinburgh show, the most recent one, are you touring it at the moment?
No, that's finished.
Done. That's done and dusted.
That's okay. Finished, yeah. The tour was extended.
Yeah.
To which I am doing the extension of that tour, but it's not that show because I just didn't. It was, you know, I don't think we've even mentioned it, but it was about the 7 days sort of following Strictly Come Dancing, and I just want to put all of that behind me. So it's really anything. It's sort of greatest hits, but I'm writing loads. It'll be that.
Okay.
It'll be anything.
Okay. I was just trying to get a sense during that show of whether you framing "I'm a fuck up." Look at all these panel shows I've fucked up. Look at all these opportunities I've squandered. Mm-hmm. Look at all these things. I was trying to get a sense of whether that is an accurate representation of how you feel about your life.
Yes.
Whether it's an accurate representation, whether it's an accurate representation of how you wrongly feel about your life. Like you think that, but really you're not that much of a fuck up.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
To what extent you were kind of loading that stuff as a sort of dramatic choice given, as an artistic choice, given the material that you had to get across?
Well, remember, it was also a joke. It's very important. When I knew that I was going to be approaching a sensitive subject, a sensitive time in my life, a difficult time in my life, that tonally this show would be different from other shows. Mm-hmm. But what I did not want to do was suddenly take a show up to Edinburgh that wasn't making people laugh with the force that I would normally make them laugh with. Didn't want to sacrifice anything, you understand? That's very important to me, that it is always comedy. So that bit, although it's representative of how I felt and how I feel, of course, you know, as I've said, I think it's very important, how you feel doesn't make it so. And that's fine. So, yeah, maybe I am... We could do a show about how lucky I am. That's not funny.
Yeah.
Right? It's not funny. You got to do live at the Apollo at 24 or something, or 25, 3,500 people. Did it when I was 27 with Jack D, one of my heroes. This is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I cherish it. It's not funny. So we'd leave that bit. But that whole bit where I go through all of the mistakes or errors, and not all of them, but some highlights. Mm. Various. It does lead up to the punchline, and Strictly was my one last chance to not fuck it up. Mm. That's the punchline, and obviously the entire audience know how that went.
Sure.
So it is one big joke. It's not meant to be taken too literally. Do you know what I mean? Ultimately,
yeah,
it's a joke.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But that experience of Edinburgh, you were... Was there like a news story that you'd cried on stage in the first couple of days of doing it?
So on day one, I walk out and there was less than 50 people there, and I hadn't played to that few people since my first Edinburgh. It was the first time since the kiss of death, as I call it, that I've been sort of faced with really faced with the destruction it had caused to my career. I knew that what it had done to my life, but I didn't really know. I hadn't even checked the numbers. The room was smaller than the room that, by a bit, but the room was a bit smaller than I'd done a couple of years before. And I walked out and there were less than 50 people, and I was fucking, I mean, that was the sort of lowest moment of my career, without a doubt. That was on stage. And I had to try and I'm about to do a very personal show. I'm trying to hold myself together. And in the show, I go over what was one of the happiest moments in my life. When it was true. And that was true. There was that was for no sort of comic effect, I suppose. It was to tell the story, was that this... As ridiculous as it sounds, but it was amazing on the bigger show, and things seemed to be going well, blah, 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 and done the Paso Doble, and it was fantastic. I was on such a high. It was one of the happiest moments I'd just ever been, as I described in the show, and we all know what happened next. But as I'm doing that bit, and I'm talking about this happiest moment in my life, I'm looking up, and there's a room that's not even half full, and I just a tear rolled down my face, because I thought, how have I gone from being... getting things that right to this. And I don't have a tear roll. My eyes watered. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was then reported in the Sun that I burst into tears. This was done with after the show, a person took a selfie with me, and they're the ones that went to the papers, which is why, I don't know if you noticed, for the rest of that run, I say goodbye. I don't go into my dressing room. I left out of the audience door because I became afraid of my own audience.
I think like day four, I happened to walk past you as you were clearly leaving the thing. Collar up, down.
Just terrified. Horrific. Absolutely horrific. So there were ongoing sort of these tabloid stories. And I had to sort of not let them affect the framework of the show. And that's why that's where the idea came for the show to be the 7 days, the week building up to the Charleston, mm-hmm. because it meant no matter then what anyone said, any article outside of that 7 days, it wouldn't affect that show. And that's where that creative decision came from. People could keep writing things, but it doesn't change what happened in those 7 days.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because you're talking about the 7 days leading up to it, and like I didn't watch Strictly. I don't watch Strictly. It's not my thing. Mm. I was sort of peripherally aware that you were on it.
Yeah, I know you.
And I think it was massively broadcast throughout. I mean, the viewing figures are huge in Britain. For the benefit of people who are listening to this outside of Britain,
Dancing with the Stars is it's called in elsewhere around the world.
And can you briefly tell us, in your words, what happened?
Oh, my God.
Listen.
I am not... You've got to appreciate this. I want to be... basically, look, mate, from the experience of this whole... the last year and a half, still...
Yeah.
If I just say anything...
Yeah, sure.
They take the quote, they take it out of context, and I'm just... It's really difficult. I'm not coming on here. I don't want to get upset. It's just... fucking hell, I can't say anything to you. All I can go is, I kissed my dance partner, we got photographed, and she was married and I was in a long-term relationship, and there was a very bad fallout of that, and my ex wrote a statement that sort of went viral that was But I don't even know how to word it. But and again, I'm scared to. I don't want to get
I'll,
into
I'll
it.
Oh, wait. She accused you of gaslighting her. I think that's
not
that's
in
a,
that
statement.
Not in that statement.
No? Okay.
No, not in that statement. It was then sort of interpreted by, I don't know if it was, I don't know, the social media or journalists. Sure. And then that's where that word came from. Okay. And then I think it then became the thing. The show was not a response to that, because then you're communicating to your ex through the medium of stand-up, and then if you comment on it, say in an interview or anything, then you're replying to your ex via a podcast. Sure. I can't say anything, and sure. I so I say nothing.
I understand.
And yeah.
I don't know what happened between you and your ex.
Yeah.
But equally, as soon as someone says this person was abusive, suddenly there is a, and you must have felt this, there is a kind of an industry-wide, oh, right, is that okay? Do you feel that happening throughout the industry? Do you feel the industry treating you differently?
Oh, well...
More guardedly?
Well, I think I think... The answer to that would be concise, is it's been very damaging. And I think that answers your question. Of course it has. Yeah.
When you did that show, your position in that show was, my career's over. To what extent did you ever really feel that? To what extent did you feel that at the time you were saying it on stage? And to what extent was that kind of amplified for the sake of a comic position?
You go out there, people laugh, and I suppose it's not. Of course, it's not over. And I think, it just didn't go the way I suppose it was meant to. You know, like when you do a show, the biggest show apparently on television, what might come from that, you know. The fruits of that. It is almost like none of it ever happened, because you're just sort of left back where you were.
Do you have to cover it when you start a gig?
No,
now?
Absolutely not.
You just back straight.
And that's a bit of a rule.
Yeah. From day one.
Where was it? After Edinburgh.
Okay,
that was it. There's no reference. It actually came up the other day, and I don't mind, but I don't open with it or anything.
It came up in the sense of someone heckled you about it?
No, not heckled, but what happened? I was telling her, the audience, about a personal training session I had, this sort of boxing class. And then I thought I better explain why I'm doing a boxing class. And then that led to the Strictly stuff. So,
in what way? What were you?
Well, because, you know, I can't.
As far as I know, you did a boxing routine on Strictly. I'm sorry, I've got no idea what the link is.
Yeah, so I don't, but I really don't want to sort of dwell on this too much, because you're not looking for. I'm just so scared of the quotes. I'm so scared of. It looks like I'm looking for sympathy. I'm so scared of the way these things can be negatively either twisted, or it just is negative, and I'm saying the wrong thing. But it's had a very serious effect on my life and my well-being.
The bit where you kicked a ball against your neighbour's wall,
yes,
was one of the funniest act outs I've ever seen.
Oh, I'm glad you like that. Yeah, so what was I trying to do? Full disclosure, that's one of the routines that was going to be in after this one. I'm going home
okay,
before Strictly. So, So that, when I was concerned about, you know, is this that thing, I've got to keep this funny. This can't turn into one of those shows where people aren't laughing, they have to be laughing. There was a, well, how could I get that in? And I thought it might just illustrate my childhood a little bit. And it probably did a little bit. And my dad, my dad's in that routine. So it's it's just me and my friends when we used to kick the ball against the fence and kick the ball over the fence. And my dad would come out and call me in for dinner. And I found my dad very embarrassing growing up. So I enjoyed doing that. I mean, when you've, I'll tell you what, when you, where did I do that? I can't remember doing that routine somewhere. So yeah, for the people listening that don't know, when we were kids, so I didn't realise there were sort of international listeners with soccer, football, children in this country will take the ball out into the street and sort of use a back garden fence or a bus stop as a goal and repeatedly boot a football against a fence for like 12 hours. And so what I did is just repeat. It was about how I couldn't believe, like when the neighbours would tell us to leave or quiet down or stop kicking the ball against a fence. And now at 34, I look back at that and think, what must that have been like? Because I can't stand it when, you know, if the neighbours are upstairs talking late, booting a ball for 12 hours. So just repeatedly acted that out. That was a lot of fun. But if you do that routine at a gig that isn't going too well...
because it requires absolute commitment.
Absolute
continually
commitment.
Continually miming, banging your ball against the wall.
Yeah. Oh, there's definitely a couple of Edinburgh shows where that routine lasted about 12 seconds. Or, you know, or I got the sense that, okay, it's got off to a hard... Say it was a... What's a difficult one in Edinburgh? Monday or Wednesday or something? When I always had a bad, tough Wednesday one. Wednesday, you'd come out, they're not really going for it. Drop that. I wouldn't do the football bit. Be like, that is not going to fly.
When you come up with a routine like that, or I was talking to another comic about, you know, act outs generally, and they said one of their favourite act outs ever was you doing hooking a ball out from under a car. It's another football-related one.
No, that's in it.
Oh, is that in it?
That's
is that bit?
That's I from that, that but I probably just chopped it out for time.
Fair news,
but that's from that when the ball gets stuck underneath the car, you've got to get it out, yeah.
Do you? He was talking about the detail, the attention to detail, and we were kind of speculating. How much of that in the writing of a routine is you looking out the window in a cafe and thinking, I could act that out? And how much of it is you like they're so specific? Like, I find act outs a really creative kind of place to be on
right.
stage. If you get a funny idea, they're laughing, you do an act out, they laugh more, you actually end up writing three more jokes. I do in the act out, because when I'm in the act out, I'm just in a silly mood and I do more and I come up with more punchlines.
Yes.
So how, like, do you go on and, like, the first time you did that bit, did you do it for ages because you knew that was going to be the joke? Did you inhabit it? Did you act it really well? You're so good at act outs. Like, where does that originate?
That's the fun, isn't it? For me, it's the point. I tell you, I can't. I imagine no one said this on your podcast. I can't stand writing. I like writing sitcoms. I write other things for myself. But stand up, I can't bear it.
It comes up from time to time.
And it's, does it?
Yeah, yeah.
Right,
part
it does
of why
come
I
up.
Started this was because at the time I couldn't bear writing.
I can't.
Because I would try and write jokes longhand on a blank piece of paper. It was mad. It's horrifying.
Yeah. So I said this to someone the other day. It might have been on a thing. I don't know. Excuse me. So I was working on this episode of a thing that I'm working on. And I was writing that on the iPad in my local cafe, and just enjoying myself. And what I do like about that is the difference between working on a script and your stand-up is, with the script, there's the distance. This isn't about me. This is about the character. And you can, certainly with the characters I try and write, you know, I choose elements of myself, but this is not me. And you can have fun with it. So I'm there and I'm peacefully writing, and I think I finish a draft or something. Right, I better start writing some stand-up. This is my, what is it? Bread and what? Bread and bricks and water? What's it, the phrase? Bread and butter.
Bread and butter,
Bread and water, bread and butter. Well, you know, this is my job, essentially, and everything else is a luxury. Yeah. So right, stand-up. So I put the iPad up, right, notes, and just immediately I just go... Oh, fucking hell. And I write like this. So the listeners that can't see, I've got my left hand over my eye, sort of going up onto my forehead, and I'm stressed, and my eyes are shut, and that's how I write. It's the whole thing is just a bit like I said earlier about waking up, just, ah, fuck! Just fuck, I've got, oh, fuck, I've got to do this. Oh, fuck, are they going to laugh? Ah, oh, they're not going to fucking laugh. Oh, I'm not funny. I'm fucking not funny. Why am I doing this? And that's how I write. It's just, it's a horrific experience. And then the performance, I love. I love performing. I love acting, and I love the act outs. Of course I do, because it's not really writing, is it? It's an adult being a child, and that's the most fun bit. So the more I get to boot that ball against the fence, the more I get to act, the more I get to act out, the more I get to be silly.
The less time you need to spend clutching your face.
Fuck yeah. And also, you know, I think I'd apply this maybe to myself a little bit. I think just an idea to put out there that maybe it gets sort of funnier the older you get. I don't think you can get too old, but I think 34, acting out, being sort of a bit flamboyant and energetic, is funnier than a 24-year-old doing it. Because now it doesn't. Because now it's not. Because what sort of 30? What normal 34-year-old man is ever acting out, booting a ball against the fence for 5 minutes, or picking a ball from underneath a car? Adults don't behave like this. Young people do, but adults don't. So now, I think it's becoming funny. I saw an episode of Vic and Bob. I love Vic and Bob. Very different. You know, essentially nothing in common with my work. But I was watching their show. How fucking old are they now? They're in their 60s.
I don't know how old they are, but they were grown-ups when I was a kid.
Yeah, exactly right. And I found it even funnier. They've gotten older. Like, it's made this funnier. It might not have as much public appeal. It might a broad appeal.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, that does, unfortunately, as part of life, wane the older you get. But this is funnier. They're 60s and they're doing the same thing they were doing. They must have been on telly in their 20s. This is absolutely ridiculous. This is getting more and more ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, maybe that, to myself, I thought maybe that's the case for me. Just this act is actually potentially going to get funnier because you're probably going to keep on doing it the way you do it. That's just going to be ridiculous. You're going to be 40 and jumping about the stage. It's, oh, hopefully, yeah, that'll be funnier.
Do you ever have a moment of the face-clutching writing where you go, you know, you're thinking of a thing and then you, like, you're trying to get jokes out of, I don't know what, sharpening a pencil, and then you go, oh, I could do an act out of sharpening a pencil.
No, don't not write like that.
No?
Definitely not, no.
So do you discover the act outs on stage just because you said a thing and then you think, they laughed, I'll do that?
Okay, let me try and think of something recently. Trying to get the Hoover back in the cupboard. I was struggling to get the Henry the Hoover back in the cupboard.
Yeah.
And it was a nightmare. And I thought, I'm on my own, and you sort of watch yourself, or maybe it's just me, but your whole life feels like I'm in this sort of sitcom, and I'm trying to get this over in the cupboard, and it's a nightmare, and things are falling out, and you sort of see this, and you think, oh, this is quite funny, do that. And that's it.
So do you then, once you've got that, you think, I'll try that on stage, and it works, and then what, after the fact, you go, I'll need a couple of jokes about Hoovers to get into that?
Will it be like, so, it'll be like how, what's this, how, where does it come off now? Just, I suppose it was about life compared to what I thought it would be. You know, when you're in your late teens and you're jumping up and down to Mr. Brightside with these people that you think will be your best friends till death, and you're singing this together and you're holding them and you're sharing each other's sweat, you forget about hoovering. You can't escape hoovering.
Yeah.
It will happen and you will have to do it. And that's it. And that's true.
But that, and that is, so where does that thought come from? Because to me, that's like, funny thing happens in Sean's life, sitcom of your life. You go, I can act that out well. And I'm laughing because I can already imagine you acting, getting the Hoover back in the cupboard. It's a problem. And I like, you're good at suffering. You know what I mean?
I'm very good at suffering.
You're good at suffering.
I'm very good.
That's where the act outs come from. If you're doing like a 3 minute I'm vomiting into the bowl of a toilet act out, you're committed to it. You're good at suffering.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then you've got the bit of you, the part of your brain, which is a writer's brain, that goes, actually, if I, which way round does it happen? Do you go, do you know what? I never thought my life would be like this.
Yes.
I thought I'd always be bouncing around to Mr. Brightside. Yeah. That's the next sequential thought.
That's it.
And then you just put them backwards and go, you know, when you're dancing around to Mr. Brightside, you never realise.
No, I actually mentioned the hoovering. It just comes out in the order you think of it. Yes, it's not far removed. None of my, I'm sure this will surprise no one. Not much of my stand-up is very far from when I first thought of it.
Okay, well, so my next question.
Apart from the after this one, I'm going home. The Strictly
sure,
show
sure,
was,
sure.
was very different, but the routines, yeah, no, there's really that.
You think of a thing, you do it, it gets a laugh, you do it harder. Times X number of shows,
and
that's
of course,
a show.
Yeah, and the more you do this routine, the more you do it. Keep doing it. I mean, that's the sort of technique, I suppose, in itself is now keep doing this routine, and this routine will somehow keep getting better. That is important. I remember one thing I discovered when I was younger doing stand-up is I would feel like something was funny. I would do it, and it wouldn't work. And you know, like this thing of like try. I remember people used to say like try it 3 times and then bin it. But I would like no, I'll try this 10 times, and I'll just keep on doing it. And I would change nothing, and then it would work. Just keep doing it.
Why?
Because it's the fact that I'm not having now to remember it. The fact that I've got so comfortable to do it. I know how I'm to do it. Now you're probably selling it like it does work, and now it does.
That's never come up before, and it has the ring of truth.
Just keep.
You're selling it like it works, and then suddenly it works.
Yeah, there you go.
Jesus. And conversely, do you have bits that suddenly stop working, and you can't identify why?
The worst we all know is. The closest I could relate to that is just when you try something, maybe something comes up off the top of your head, the most beautiful moment for all of us as stand-ups, and then the next time you try it, and there's just nothing, and you didn't, because you didn't have that moment.
Yeah, what
like, I don't really write,
genuine
but,
realisation.
Yeah, I don't know what I created there that made them laugh. I don't know what the fuck that was, and I've tried to recreate it, but I really don't know what it was, and that's now just in that gig. That is such a shame.
What other elements of your process are peculiar to you? Do you ever record your gigs? Do you ever watch back tapes from, you know,
never
from
watch,
Top Secret?
Never watch. Always record on my phone. Always, always record. Never listen. Never, ever listen. The only time I'll go back and listen is when that happens, and you end up doing... You say something that you didn't ever think of off stage. Well, then I need to listen back to it because I don't actually know what I said.
Yeah.
And I go, that. Okay, good. Right. Say that. But what happened last time, which relates back to what I was just saying, is I didn't bother recording it on my phone. Top Secret have the videos that film you. So I just thought, I'll look at that back if I need to. Did end up going off on one. The audio went, I don't know what I said. it was killing it. Don't know what it was.
That's kind of beautiful somehow, isn't it? That's poetic. I said the funniest thing I ever said.
Yeah.
And then the audio went wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the people died immediately after.
Yeah, yeah,
no one
yeah.
can remember this
yeah.
moment.
Well, no, because my friend Joanne McNally was there, and I was calling her up and go, what did I... And Nick Dixon was there. I was going, what did I say? But they don't know. It's because we all both know it's how you said it. Why were you... it's so many things. It's not just the words. Or if it is the words, we both know it's the exact words. So they're going, yeah, it was about not turning it up. Yeah, I know, but...
Yeah.
No, I need exactly how I said it.
It was exactly how you said it. And it was the fact it was at the end of a breath
it
and
was
you'd
the,
run out
all
of breath
that,
or all of that kind
all
of stuff.
All of that, yeah.
What structure do you actually... Like you say, you know, like you're saying, it's not. It won't surprise people to know that what you do on stage is not like it hasn't changed much since when you thought of it. And it's a lovely way of putting it. When that happens, what if any additional work do you do to it? Do you order the routines? Do you, or is it just
gig,
thrashing it out?
Just keep gigging. You'll feel it. Well, okay. I mean, I wish I had more of a sort of work. What do you call it?
Ethic.
Well, yeah, but I do in my own way. You know, I think about it a lot. I just don't. It's just not written down anywhere.
Yeah.
But is to go back and gig it and gig it again. Okay, what went wrong? You got another gig tomorrow. Okay, well, don't I drop that bit? Do that bit. Right. I'll be make more sense if actually that was there.
Is that all in your head? Do you make any notes on paper?
No. Occasionally, I didn't the other day. I did a work in progress show. I did mix it with some old, but there's just nothing written down. Because it's what you think.
Words on your hand, like that?
Absolutely, never done the words on the hand thing. I used to scribble down subjects, but I don't even do that anymore because it's... I probably will do, but, like, I'm going to talk about my life. And I do know what's going on in my life, so I'm going to remember, aren't I? I don't need to... You don't turn up at the pub and go, right, here's some things I've got written down that I'm going to tell you about. And it's the same thing for me. I've got an hour. I told you about, well, you know, where did we start?
Yeah.
You know, we're catching up. So that's it, really, isn't it?
Do you never come off stage and think, oh, God, I completely forgot to do my bit about bin bags?
Yeah, but then I'll remember at the next one, so it's all right.
So you've managed to be nerveless.
Mm.
You walked on.
Mm.
Something goes wrong.
Mm.
You have a wobble.
Yeah.
The nerves come back. How do you get rid of them in the moment?
Well, actually, I was doing. I did a last minute glee on Saturday, and what happened? I walked out, did the opener, and I just slipped over. I just tripped over one of my words in the opening line, which obviously doesn't play. Well, you don't want to slip over on the first line.
Yeah,
bad place to trip up. So obviously, I didn't really connect with the opening line as well as I'd wanted to. Then we get on to the next bit, and now I've realised the next bit that I've chosen to do, I hadn't really often been doing as the sort of second bit, and realised, God, actually, this has got a bit of a setup, and one of the lines comes from not remembering what I've got to say.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about Greta... Thunberg?
I'm going to say Thunberg because...
You're going to correct me?
I had Matt Winning on the show, and he's a climate change researcher, and he referred to it as Greta Thunberg.
Oh, fine, great.
I've done that ever since without questioning it.
Great, good. So Thunberg, and then what happens is I get one of her sort of... You know, I get her message, what she's trying to, you know, spread around the world. I sort of get it wrong, and I don't really know it. So I'm getting to this line, I'm like, man, you fucked up your first line. And now I've just realised the second line is actually a mistake. Well, now it just looks like you don't know what you're doing. Oh, bollocks. But now I've got in too far, so I'm going to have to say this line. Say the line. Obviously, no one laughs. They just think, this guy, he's gone on Strictly. This is the last time we've seen him. Now he's back. He's lost it. He doesn't know what's going on. And you just have to remember, I'm not gonna smash this gig now for 20 minutes. I've already not done that, so that's not happening. You're not killing the set. You've already not killed the set. So just know that this is better than most of the shit that people see. and it'll be all right. It will be fine. Barcelona don't win. Compare myself to Barcelona. But you just, all of us, apart from Liverpool, you don't win every game. All right. And it's fine. And you don't let the nerves get involved. You just go, you fucked it. Carry on. It's work.
You change the stakes effectively. You go, the job is no longer to smash the set because that can't happen anymore.
Exactly,
So the job is to just enjoy yourself and walk off with your head held high.
Yeah.
And then you reset the bar and then probably you get really funny again,
right? And everyone have a nice time. Maybe some people didn't enjoy it so much. Maybe some people enjoyed it more. Actually, they enjoyed it just as the amount you wanted them to. But let's face it, we didn't really murder tonight. I was on first. It'd be all right. It'd be fine. And I did the next gig and we had a great time.
That confidence that everything will be all right. Is that at odds with your personality?
My person, we're talking life versus work, aren't we? The work is my. I would say I'm a. You know, been around some time now. I know how to make big rooms of people laugh and small rooms of people laugh. I know what I'm doing, and you just know from a bit of experiences. I used to get so depressed, and you, of course, you did. We all did. You used to get so depressed after that tough gig, and it's fine, isn't it? You're okay now, and I'm okay now. There's a bit of that. It's just life. It's experience. You just go, okay, well, mate, you fucked it. I know the reason I tripped over my word is because I didn't really decide exactly how I was going to say that before I walked out, which is why I've slipped over it, because it was a bit about thingy. Schofield. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, yeah, say that. But I didn't really word it tightly enough. So, yeah, so you just know, well, you're going to storm. What am I going to do? Never storm again? This was the end. We trip up on the first line, and this was the end now. Never going to storm again. And of course not. You're going to storm again.
But this
it's fine.
Not to ask you the same question again, but that level of kind of self-awareness and unshakable confidence in your ability, and like a really healthy bit of logic, like, what am I never going to storm again? Like, can you apply those qualities to your own peace of mind, your own mental stability?
Well, yes, working on it. Absolutely, yes, I think you can, and absolutely working on it. But that's not funny, so we'll have to keep a bit of the madness.
That was Sean Walsh. There's another 40 minutes, 40 to 45 minutes of stuff from Sean available on the Insiders Club. You can join at comedianscomedian.com/insiders and get access to that and all of the other extra content from any episode that has it. I'm really grateful to Sean for being so candid. I do appreciate the situation he's in with regard to how he has to watch what he says for fear of it being dissected and amplified and what have you. And I think you can hear from the way he talks about the whole situation with Strictly and everything that followed, that he has been profoundly affected by that situation. And I think the way he talked about it, I'm not going to go into any further detail on that because I think it speaks for itself. And I'm pleased that we got to hear Sean wrestling with some of that fallout. I'm very grateful to him for coming along and being so honest. So I'm going to leave that there. Thanks to Sean. Thanks to Angel Comedy, as ever, for letting us record. And thank you to Jake Crossland for logging the episode, Rob Smouten for the music, Peter Dobbing is your podcast consultant, and Nathan Wood is your editor, producer, and uploader of the show. All of the extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And do remember, I am at Cambridge for the end of the tour on the 28th of February. You might just have time in between downloading and listening to this to grab your tickets and tell all of your friends in Cambridge. That is the final performance of End Of, and I'm really looking forward to it. It is now selling very satisfyingly, but it would be lovely to completely stuff and fill it. That's all for now. I look forward to talking to you next week. We have some absolute belters in the can, and you will know if you're a member of the Facebook group, the fabulous guest that is now confirmed and is going to come out in a couple of weeks. If you're not in the Facebook group, you can jump on a huge thread with about 80 questions for this extremely significant and seminal figure in British comedy. So jump on that and you can get a little sneak preview. I'll speak to you next week. Thanks for listening.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.